Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hi, I'm Sabine.
And I'm Adam. Welcome to the 34th episode of Robots. In today's show, we have an exclusive interview with Dean Kamen, considered by some as the greatest inventor alive. He's the father of the insulin pump, the Segway, and the new Luke arm prosthesis for amputees. To encourage creativity and to break the stereotypes attributed to scientists, Kamen created FIRST, which is attracting kids from around the world to robotics competitions.
To celebrate creativity and invention, we want to know what you think is the best invention of all times. We'll be giving away what I think is the ultimate winner, Swiss chocolate. But before, let's hear the latest news in robotics from Christine.
Thanks, Sabine. Scientists at the University of the West of England are working on the design of a biological robot based on slime molds. Previous research on slime molds has already shown their capability to solve complex computational tasks such as shortest path and maze problems and even been used to control a robot. Slime molds have also been shown to be able to transport objects using oscillating tubes. The new robot, affectionately named Plasmobot, will be able to pick up objects by engulfing them with the final goal to achieve microassembly. While still far off, fully biological amorphous robots would be massively parallel and would come with many built-in advantages over their silicon counterparts, including cheap replication, self-healing, and naturally biodegradability. You may remember our previous report on Japan's 18-meter-high Gundam robot erected in the center of Tokyo. In what seems to be a serious case of envy, Korea's robotic theme park Robot Land, currently under construction in Incheon, some 30 kilometers west of Seoul, has now announced plans to construct a robot statue more than six times higher. At 111 meters, Korea's robot statue will stand more than twice as high as the Statue of Liberty. The Robot Land theme park is set to open in July 2012. Following the bankruptcy of robot toy maker Yugobi earlier this year and the subsequent rescue of its beloved Pleo dinosaur toy by Jetta Company Unlimited, first news of the robot dinosaur's future are beginning to emerge. Jetta has announced plans for its alpha version of a Pleo developer kit to be available this September, and first videos of Pleo performing some brand new dance moves have begun to emerge. This shows Jetta is serious about continuing the Pleo line. Good news for current Pleo owners and future fans, us included. For more information on Plasmobots based on slime molds, the 111-meter-high Korean robot statue, or Pleo's future, visit our website at www.robotspodcast.com/forum.
Dean Kamen is an inventor who changes lives. As a starting point for most of his ideas, there is a clear belief that some things just should exist. That's why he didn't even wait to finish college to invent the first wearable infusion pump, which rapidly gained acceptance in the medical field. Kamen's current facade for his crazy ideas, Decker Research, is rolling out products such as the Segway, the Luke arm prosthesis, and systems to bring clean water and energy to people in need. However, not only is Kamen inventing, he is also passionate about creating inventors through FIRST, which is a framework for robotic competitions reaching 150,000 kids around the world. Needless to say, his strong case of invention hyperactivity has led him to receive multiple honorary doctorates from top universities and the National Medal of Technology, presented to him by President Clinton in the year 2000. During this interview, he'll be telling us what he thinks is a good idea and how he hopes that engineers will be tomorrow's pop stars.
Hi, Dean. Welcome to Robots.
And thank you for inviting me.
Can you please present yourself to our listeners?
I'm Dean Kamen. My day job is designing and building various kinds of medical equipment. That's our primary day job. We have a few hundred engineers working hard at that all the time. But my passion, and I hope a substantial part of this conversation will be about FIRST, which is a nonprofit organization we started 18 years ago that hopes to bring science and technology to more kids and, frankly, more schools and more companies in a fun, positive way that engages more people ultimately in getting involved in careers in science and technology.
Why was there a need for FIRST?
I think the reason there's a need for FIRST is while a lot of places make the supply of technology education available, schools, libraries, journals, our culture has done a very good job, I think unintentionally, but nonetheless, our culture has done a very good job of making all sorts of other things, particularly the world of sports and entertainment, seem very exciting, very accessible, and very financially, and in other ways, rewarding to kids. And in fact, most of the role models presented to kids in the American culture come from Hollywood or come from professional sports, the NBA, the NFL. And as a consequence of that, particularly women and minorities in the United States, by the time they're teenagers, instead of being enthusiastic to work hard, to study science, technology, mathematics, to prepare themselves for great careers, instead, frankly, waste a lot of their time chasing the great American dream. You know, they'll spend hours a day bouncing a ball or doing other things to try to develop skill sets that are unlikely to lead to careers. Then they get to 17 or 18 years old, and they're not prepared for exciting jobs. They're not prepared to go to college. And so we thought, with all the supply out there going unused and so many kids literally dropping out of high school, we need to create an organization that is competing with the NFL or competing with Hollywood for the hearts and minds of kids. And we thought, since we have a culture that's obsessed with sports and entertainment, if we could put science and technology into a venue and a format that in every way captures all the excitement and fun of sports and entertainment, but has the content of science and technology, we might be able to, through our organization, spark a whole lot of kids, light a fire in a whole lot of kids while they're still young enough to change their thinking, that will induce them to put their energy and their passion into learning and to becoming prepared for careers in science and technology. And we do that through FIRST in the same way sports works. In the world of sports, the way you get kids interested in football or basketball is you show them the best of the best. You put these role models in front of them. Shaquille O'Neal. Well, where is the Shaquille O'Neal of electrical engineering or mechanical engineering or systems or controls or software or computers? Well, they're in our companies, they're in our laboratories, our federal laboratories, they're at NASA. So we've convinced hundreds and at this point thousands of technology companies and federal laboratories to ask some of their young scientists and engineers to work with us, to be the role models that work with kids all over the country to show these kids how exciting the world of science and technology really are.
I can totally see that when you're in these competitions, I myself did some robotics competitions where you really, you do feel like the hero you're talking about, and you see your robots going and they're the best of the team, etc. But how do you actually get them in these teams? Do you think it's a new generation of people who will be more convinced by engineering and inventions than maybe my generation?
I think the reason that FIRST went from the very general goal of convincing all kids that science and technology really is accessible, fun, cool, important, to the very specific method which uses robots in our robots competition. The reason we use that specific model, the robot competition, is because kids these days really can see and understand what a robot does physically. It lends itself to a visually exciting sport. You know, it's hard to show genomics or proteomics or hydrodynamics or some esoteric bit of physics or engineering as being exciting. But robotics involves and engages so many different aspects of engineering: electrical, mechanical, software, sensors, controls, energy supplies, batteries, motors. And yet when you're finished building your robot, you also get to see it literally running around or picking things up or shooting things or in some kind of very visual competition. The robot to us seemed like a way that you could relate to kids, you could create a sport, you could bring in many different aspects of engineering, you could create a format in which a season that's no longer than a typical high school sporting season of 6 or 8 weeks could allow you to start the project, complete the project, and then compete with it. For all sorts of reasons, we thought, let's use the robot, no pun intended, as the vehicle to get to the kids, and let's go out to industry and find mentors that are willing to play with these fun devices using really state-of-the-art tools and technology that we put in the kits to get these kids excited, and it's working.
You spoke of girls and minorities before. Are you doing anything special to get these proportions of the population interested?
We're doing all sorts of things to get the kids that might never have met a scientist or engineer or have these terribly wrong stereotypes of scientists and engineers as all being middle-aged white males and all being boring people that don't fit. It's always good for a cheap laugh in the movies that the kids that are science-oriented are geeky and nerdy and don't fit in the social scheme. It's always another cheap laugh to show the scientists as these frizzy-haired old guys. But we ask all the companies to go out and go to schools where the kids probably don't ever get to meet a real scientist or engineer in their personal lives, and show them what they do. And as a result of that, we have seen, I think last year, 38% of the kids on these robotics teams were women and minorities of all kinds, Hispanics and African American, and the fact that the school gets so engaged at every level in this competition breaks down the barriers and breaks down the stereotypes. So while it's maybe not 50%, it's way, way, way higher than, frankly, the actual number of scientists and engineers that are right now in our workforce that are women and minorities. And we are every year getting better at attracting more and more of a broad base of all the students, because all these students need exciting careers, and they all need to be prepared for those careers by getting smart.
How long do you think it'll take to get rid of this geeky stereotype? When will scientists be the role models?
I wish I knew how long it takes to get rid of a stereotype. When I started this program 18 years ago, you might think I'm naive, but at the end of the first season, since every single team loved it, every mentor loved it, every teacher, every parent, every student, at the end of that first season when we tried this big experiment, I asked them all, do you want to come back next year? And 100% of the 20-some-odd teams said, they're coming back. All the kids, all the parents, all the teachers, all the mentors wanted to come back. I thought, we'll just get into every school quickly. We've proved the experiment works. Let's go. Well, we doubled the second year to over 50 teams. We doubled again the third year. We doubled again. And part of me says, we're doing pretty damn well considering we now have thousands of teams and we keep growing at a great rate. But on the other hand, to your question, how long does it take to break a stereotype? Even after 18 years, we're nowhere near in every school in this country. We're nowhere near having the cultural impact of having broken that stereotype. So sadly, I think it might take a generation to break that stereotype, but we're working as hard and as fast as we can, and we need help from everybody out there to make it happen.
I might be pushing it, but when will you be in Europe?
We are already in Europe.
Really?
We had teams come this year to the finals from 42 countries. We have not only teams from outside the U.S., but we now have some entire regional events leading up to our finals and our championship around other countries. Canada has a few regionals. There was a regional in Brazil. There was a regional in Tel Aviv in Israel. We have lots of activity going on in Singapore, Korea, China. So we are becoming international.
And I wish I were a kid, but if I were, how would I get involved?
That's a great question. I think many people think that somehow FIRST is sort of statically out there and those that are involved do it and the rest of us watch, the way we all see professional sports on television. Nothing could be further from the truth. It's very, very easy to get involved in FIRST, and if you look at all the new teams we get each year, it's kind of an even distribution as to how that new team got formed. Sometimes it's kids that heard from other kids at another school about this great program, and they go and push it with their teachers or their parents or some local technology business. Sometimes it's a business that's seen this work, and they have multiple sites, and their engineers from one site talk to another, and they go find a new school in a new city. Sometimes it's an energetic parent that shows up and asks the school board or the principal or the teachers, hey, why aren't our kids getting opportunities to participate in this kind of activity? But the real answer is FIRST is now growing as a very organic, bottoms-up organization, and individual students or parents or teachers or engineers or corporate types can jump in, form a team, join up in the same way that every community finds a way to get involved in creating their little league teams. Every community's got to get involved and make FIRST happen. And we make it as easy as we can. If they went to the FIRST website, usfirst.org, or just go to Google and hit the word FIRST and hit enter, and we're the very first thing you see, because Larry Page and Sergey Brin from Google are big supporters of FIRST, and they make it easy to find us on Google. So anybody can get to FIRST, and once you get there, you can find a way to get involved, and everybody that gets involved, I think it's safe to say, gets more out of it than they put into it. So that's why we keep growing.
This really seems like your passion. What is your best memory with FIRST?
Oh, I have so many best memories with FIRST. We don't have time to talk about them, but frankly, I would sound like a zealot and you would discount what I say, but all you have to do is show up at a FIRST event. All you have to do is go walk through the pits and see the energy and self-confidence and excitement in all these kids and the pride of the engineers and the parents and the teachers when they participate. And to me, you know, I look at the news every day and it's generally pretty crummy and pretty depressing and pretty scary, you know. The polar caps are melting. We're running out of fuel. We're running out of clean air. Terrorism, swine flu. There's no limit to the crisis du jour, the economic situation. And then you go to a FIRST event and what you see is hope and passion and confidence and optimism in everybody that participates. They're all doing the right things for the right reasons, preparing for a better world in the future. So my best memories of FIRST are it's the best antidote I know to a world that seems to be sometimes in a very dismal state. And to me, it represents the hope of the future.
You really embody the inventor FIRST is trying to encourage. How did you become an inventor?
You know, I've been asked many times, how did I, quote, become an inventor? I don't think I ever became an inventor. I never got up one morning and said, this is what I'm going to do. I think as a result of trying to create a product to meet a need, you go through this process of understanding the problem, then looking at the different technologies, then trying to combine the technologies, then trying to build the thing, and then getting support for that or getting companies to want to help you put it in production. You look back after years of doing that on different project and you decide, well, I wasn't some of the other label descriptions of people in the business or engineering world, and they call you the inventor. But I think we have to demystify that, just the way we demystify the stereotype of an engineer. But I don't think inventors are really those crazy, wacky people that run around doing zany things and one day pop up with a new invention that they thought of overnight. I think the world of harnessing science and the tools of engineering to create new kinds of products that hopefully meet important needs is an exciting way to spend your time. And I think the skill sets to do that, the science and engineering background to do that, as well as the, you know, maybe entrepreneurial drive or willingness to take risks and willingness to fail, frankly, and pick yourself up and try again, all of that collectively makes some people inventors.
Let's talk a bit about what you called your day job before. What type of products are you inventing, developing at DECA?
Well, DECA, as I said, is my day job. I've now got about 300 engineers here, and we work primarily on medical projects. We make various kinds of hardware and electronics and software for treating people with end-stage renal failure, dialysis patients. We've made some very large products like iBots, sort of a robot that can carry a human payload up and down a flight of stairs, and very, very tiny products like stents that go inside your vascular system to prop open veins that would be clogged. And we've made blood pumps and drug delivery pumps of various kinds. And we work on a whole host of medical products using a whole host of engineering capabilities. We have mechanical engineers, electrical engineers, systems engineers, controls engineers, metallurgists, plastics, and injection molding people. And we work on trying to design better ways to give people better therapies. And that's our day job.
And how does an idea end up at DECA and develop into a product?
I would say about half the ideas that are being developed at any one time at DECA come from our clients and our partners that we've had in some cases for 20 or 30 years. Big companies that know what the needs are and know how to get to the people that need a better therapy. And they come to us and say, can you build this? Can you make this better? Can you take this dialysis machine that was meant for in-center use and make it simple enough and small enough and safe enough for people to do in their own bedroom at home every night? And half of our projects are like that. And the other half start out affectionately known around here as Dean's crazy ideas. That in many cases do turn out to be crazy. We work on something for a while and then decide the technology is just not available to do it, or maybe there's somebody else has come up with a better way to address this problem. But every once in a while, one of Dean's crazy ideas turns into a prototype of something that looks like, that might really work. And then we take it to one of these big clients or partners that I told you about and said, hey, you know, here's something that we think could be a very significant improvement to people's quality of life, and we think we can reliably build this. You have the people and the global reach and the distribution and the manufacturing and marketing. Let's do this together. And then we turn it into a project. So at any one time, we're always cooking up ideas that may or may not turn into projects. And when they do turn into projects, we partner up with big companies and bring them to the world.
What do you think makes a good idea?
What makes a good idea? Well, I think that's there's a lot that goes into that question. I think to us, it has to be a technical challenge that while it may be difficult, we have to convince ourselves it's actually doable. There's a lot of things we'd like to do now for which the technology just isn't available or practical, and it would be expensive and frustrating to try to do something that isn't going to happen, at least not soon. So that's not a good idea. Then there's lots of ideas that people say, just because there's great technology now, we suddenly can do things. The technology has made this, in fact, sometimes easy to do, but we look at it and say, so what? You know, just doing it because the technology can do it doesn't make it a good idea. We think a good idea is one that is both now technically feasible, but if it succeeds, it'll allow us to make something that really will improve the quality of life in some sustainable way for a reasonable group of people. And if we believe it's doable, and that if it's done and done right, it'll get into the world, it'll be sustainable so that it can grow and affect a significant number of people, we will get to work on it. And in the end, I guess, it turns out to be a good idea if all of that happens, and history will show that it was a stupid idea if, after we spent a lot of time and a lot of money, either it wasn't technically doable, or after we did it, it didn't meet the needs that we expected it to meet, and therefore wasn't sustainable. So what is a good idea, I think, is best answered by history. But up front, we simply look for something that's challenging but doable, and that is worth the technical risk and the time and energy, in the sense that if we finish it, it's not some kind of silly amusement of some kind or a distraction. It has to be something that matters to people.
You have more than 400 patents. Is that more than 400 good ideas?
No, I think the number of patents that you get is not really in a one-to-one relationship with how many, quote, good ideas you have, because one good idea might be a product like a home dialysis machine, but to accomplish the goal of making that good idea a reality, you might have to invent things that are electrical, mechanical, disposable, plastic technology, software. It might be dozens of patents, or more than dozens of patents in some cases, to make one good idea a reality. I think patents represent unique ways to solve individual problems, and a good idea is the right collection of solutions to a problem to create something that will make the world a better place.
I'd love to dive into one of the robotics projects you have, the Luke arm. Can you maybe give us an overview of this?
Yes, the Luke arm is a project that we were asked to develop by DARPA, part of the Defense Department, because so many of the kids that have been involved in these wars, like in Iraq and Afghanistan, have been injured by IEDs. And as a consequence, they've literally had their entire upper arms, in some cases, blown off their bodies, and in a few cases, both of their arms. There are some of these kids coming back that are bilaterally missing their arms. And DARPA came to us and said, look, at the end of the Civil War 150 years ago, you know, we basically put a wooden stick on these kids when they lost an arm and with a hook on the end of it. And now 150 years goes by, we put a plastic stick on them with a hook on it. And we've got to do better. And with all the science and all the technology and all the computing capability and all the sensor capability out there, we ought to do a lot better. And we agreed with them. And we thought it would be a good idea to combine all the currently available technologies to see if we could help give them back something that would restore some, in fact, compared to a stick and a hook, a significant amount of the capability of their original equipment, that arm with that wrist and that hand and those fingers and that opposed thumb that could sense temperature and pressure and could be controlled in a meaningful way. So we set out to build a 21st century prosthetic arm, and we've spent a couple of years doing it, and I'm proud to tell you that we've got a bunch of soldiers now, veterans, that are wearing the experimental arms, and we're getting very exciting feedback that these devices are being very, very well received, and they're very useful to the people that are wearing them, and we're now trying to both advance the capability of these arms and figure out ways to get them in production so more of these kids that need them can have them.
How do you actually control the Luke arm?
So the way we control the Luke arm now, since we weren't sure what would be the winning strategy for these kids, is we hedged our bets, and we really have a couple of completely different unrelated methods. One really is fairly invasive and actually does pull electrical signals directly through something called targeted reinnervation of nerves that have, not by us, but by some pretty adept surgeons, have been made accessible so that with little electrodes like you'd use on an EKG machine, we can pick up signals and learn what the user's trying to do. At the other extreme, we have external devices that might seem much more like a very sophisticated joystick that you can use your existing physical capabilities to control many of the individual joints and functions of the arm. And then on top of that, we've developed some software that can make macro motions, pre-programmed events happen that only have to be called up from libraries. So we're using a mix and match of many different strategies to figure out what is the most useful for these kids. And I'm happy to tell you, whereas I thought at least one, two, or three of these strategies would fall away as being impractical and we would quickly figure out which is the best one to go with, rather the opposite has happened, which is all of these strategies each seem to be working pretty well and are moving very nicely. So we continue to push all of them because, A, some patients may like some better than others, and, B, they're all working well enough that, down the road we may end up building a sophisticated system that has multiple control strategies.
I was really amazed by the videos of seeing them take a grape and be able to eat it in that way. What I notice is that, for example, with the Segway, it was a very human-centered interface. And also with this arm, it looks like a very human-centered interface, as opposed to as with computers. Is this a way of the future?
Well, I believe that, the best user interface to anything with a computer in it is one that you don't see or have to learn. And we have worked hard on the Luke project to make sure that rather than have the person learn about systems and software and controls, that in fact the sophistication of the arm is that the arm really should be doing all the learning about the user and the user's capability and needs, and the interface from the user's perspective should be intuitive. It should be as close to what the original equipment was as we can get with the limits of the technology we're using. But, you know, if I asked you to pick up your finger and put it in front of your nose and wiggle it up and back, you could do it. And if I asked you, well, how are you doing that? You'd probably look at me and say, I'm just doing that. Yeah, but how are you making your finger go up and back? I see it doing that because I asked you to do it. I think in the end, unless you're a neurobiologist, you'd say, I don't know exactly how I'm doing it. I just do it. And we would like these soldiers to be able to say, yeah, I picked my arm up and I picked up that bottle of water and I drank out of it. I just did it. And to us, success is they just did it.
A word on the future now to close up. Do you think there'll be a robotics revolution just like the PC revolution 30 years ago?
I think the robotics revolution that people talk about is another one of those stereotypes, like what an engineer does. I think the answer to the question, do I think there'll be a robotics revolution, has maybe two versions. Number one, yes, I think you will see robotics in every manner of product and service that you can think of. They'll be used to do so many things, you won't be able to answer the question of where would we use robotics. any more than anybody could answer the question today, where do we use microprocessors? They're in everything. They're in every product, your car, your phone, your stereo system. They're everywhere in there because they're simple, cheap, reliable, ubiquitous. So I think, yes, you'll see a robotics revolution in the sense that there'll be more and more and more of them everywhere. But to the stereotypical perception of robots, these little walking R2-D2s or these Terminator kind of things, do I think robots in a very anthropomorphic humanoid form will become either some solution to great problems or some menace to humanity? No, I think that's a somewhat silly, naive science fiction version of robotics. The robotics that will soon be all around us will just be part of our infrastructure in a way that people don't even notice it in most cases and aren't even aware of it.
And with respect to robotics, what are your personal plans for the future?
Well, I think as sensor technologies are getting better and better, as computation gets better, simpler, cheaper, as system-level software gets easier to implement in bigger and bigger chunks, we are using more and more of these technologies to do things that, you know, are defined as robotics, and we're using it in pretty much everything we do. But as I said, we are not in the process of building a robot by the science fiction or stereotypical perception. No Terminators are being constructed here, and no R2-D2s are being constructed here other than for fun and for hobbies. But I don't think that's what the world of robotics will be.
Thanks, Dean, for being here with us on Robots.
You're very welcome.
It's amazing how some people can just invent things that no one else had even dreamed about. In the spirit of creativity, we're wondering what you, our audience, thinks is the world's greatest invention. Let us know on the forum for your chance to win a huge box of luxurious Swiss chocolate.
Feel free to be creative and add a picture or YouTube video to convince us that your favorite invention is definitely the best. And if any of you are inventors yourselves, the forum's a great place to show us what you're made of. That wraps up today's episode of Robots. For more information on our guests, visit our website at www.robotspodcast.com. And of course, don't forget to stop by the forum for discussion on today's show and other hot topics in robotics.
Thanks for listening. Hope to see you in 2 weeks.
Invent with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.